This is the Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hayes-Sinclair. Welcome to the show. Hello, everyone. Today's guest is someone who doesn't just talk about mental performance. She lives and breathes it. Renita Calhoun is a leadership and mindset coach with a resume that reads like a masterclass in high performance under pressure. She's coached Navy SEAL candidates, Fortune 500 executives, startup founders, and international development leaders across 40 countries. But don't expect the usual corporate speak here. Renita brings a rare blend of East meets West wisdom, tactical performance coaching, and a deeply human approach to leadership. She's classically trained in piano, holds an MBA from INSEAD, and get this, she once lived in a Japanese monastery. I want to know more about that too, Renita, by the way. This conversation is going to be a masterclass in staying calm under pressure, building resilience, and creating authentic high-leverage partnerships. So, Renita, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for that intro, Phil. Happy to be here.
Let's jump into the first question I'd love to ask people on this show. And instead of going back to a backstory, I'd like to understand, what mission are you on?
I love that question. I think very simply, I'm on a mission to help people and founders in particular leverage their emotional intelligence. Because what I find is that most people and founders are operating in survival mode. And it really limits their influence and their capacity to express themselves and to achieve what their goals. So once they understand how their sort of automatic emotional patterns are affecting their interactions, then they can really reconnect with their true selves. And then that's when their universe just totally upgrades.
You know, it's funny, having been a founder 8 times, you're right. There is a lot of thinking from a place of survival as opposed to a place of the ability to take a breath and breathe out and think from a place of resource, which is often the counterbalance to what every founder is experiencing. So I hear you. This is going to be very exciting for me because I feel as though there could be part insight, part therapy in this conversation. So it should be a lot of fun. So tell me, you know, your background in music, how did that shape the way you think about performance and resilience today? And I say that with the context of we have 2 daughters in school. When we often go to events at the school, there will be a musical component to it. And you see girls from the age of, I suppose, 7, maybe even earlier, who are able to play instruments like the piano extraordinarily. And you can only imagine what their brain must be computing at that time all the way through to when they're going to continue playing. So what is the translation or the bridge between playing music and the discipline with that into how you think about performance and resilience?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm a classically trained pianist, started when I was 5. And I have 2 sisters who are also musicians. So the 3 of us were all practicing at the same time. Mm-hmm. We grew up practicing 3-4 hours a day, entering competitions. Our music lessons were 2 hours away at a university in, I grew up in Iowa. Sorry, our lessons were in Iowa City. Our mother drove us there 2 hours both ways through snow, storms. So it was a lot of discipline, dedication. We really had to be focused. If she was going to dedicate that kind of time and money with an investment of many things, we really had to show up with discipline and focus and commitment. So I learned, obviously, focus and discipline, but I also learned the importance of practice, because I often saw how I would start from nothing. I'd start from learning a piece from scratch, and yet through just sheer showing up and consistently practicing and improving and having a growth mindset, which is another thing I learned, is eventually that piece would get to a place where you could perform it on stage. So those were skills that have really stood me, have served me well in very all aspects of my career. Maybe we'll talk about this later, where I think practice is such an important part of being a leader, because it's one of the few competencies where we expect people to just show up and perform at a high level without having to practice, without having practiced. And so many people don't really know how to practice.
Let's just go there now, because I think this is going to build beautifully into the rest of our conversation. The idea of practice and almost assuming that in leadership, I think without any kind of formal training, it's assumed that people will arrive ready to lead. In an entrepreneurial context, there is no more clearer path for somebody to become a CEO by them creating their own company from scratch. And so there's not, for those who have come into entrepreneurship and maybe have had, a few years work experience, or if they've built a venture out of university and come into something. I know you work with a lot of deep tech founders. Many of those people will have been in research or will have done things that are deeply technical, but with no ability to know what leadership actually looks like. I'd love to pull this apart a little bit, because the idea of practice in leadership does have the same adage, I suppose, as practice in sport, in the military, in other areas where you will have a coach, where there will be people guiding you. In leadership, often there's not that coach right now. We know that because we're coaches and we understand how important that is. But let's talk a little bit about that idea of practice, because there's many who will say, practice and the results will come. That's fine if you know what to do. But if you don't know what to do and you're sort of wing your way through it, that's very difficult to do. So tell me more about your philosophy on practice.
Yes. So there's the what and there's the how. And I used to think I could just tell people, well, you need to practice this. I used to do some career coaching and we would prepare for interviews. And I'd say, well, so, just go practice with a friend or a colleague. And I would think they would know, be able to go off and do that. And after a while, I realized they don't know how to practice. And also, so then I started incorporating role play into sessions, and I would sort of see this deer in the headlights look when I said, well, let's practice the conversation you would have. And because there's this real fear of having that conversation, even in a safe space, and that's precisely why you want to do it in a safe space, so you can feel that fear, that anxiety, to do all the things that you might do in an interview or a pitch or a board presentation or a negotiation. You want to do those things in a safe space, make the mistakes there, maybe take some risks there that you don't want to necessarily do when the stakes are high. And so that's how I teach people how to practice. I'll say, okay, we'll try it once. I'll say, let's do it again. Try it again. Let's do it again. Again? Three times? And as you know from the military, it's all about repetition. Each time, looking for a way to refine what you've done. So that's the power of practice.
You know, it's funny. There's a parallel here and an explanation. The parallel here is when people go to, like, we all have gone to school, or you go to college or graduate school, you hope at some point, like practice, that people teach you how to learn.
Yes, right.
Right? And it's, there are many people, we've just had this conversation with one of my eldest daughter's teachers around, I'm not sure, like, she's applying a huge amount of effort, but I'm not sure somebody has taught her how to learn yet. And for me, this took me until my college years to get, and geez, I wish I would have known it sooner. The same thing, I guess, can be applied to practice. And, I've, much like you, and I'm sure your musical training with your teachers, let's do it again, let's do it again. It probably felt, created the foundation for that repetition as well. But I also use the idea of, I would like you to spend time in front of the mirror getting ready, saying this thing in the morning, like literally while you're doing it. Feel comfortable looking at your own face, making the motions of the expressions of the stuff you need to say. And it is a place where you won't feel like an idiot. Your partner might hear you talking to yourself, and let's just call that healthy. But it's just one of those things where practice is super important. You know, whenever I remember my colleagues who are aviators in the Air Force or the Army, I would often see them using their hands to express maneuvers or approaches they would need to make so that they could just be in the mode to understand what's going on. For people who are on the ground, my contemporaries, whenever we had to handle different weapons or to move in particular ways, you will see them doing that as they're walking along normally because they're thinking about the motions they have to go through to be precise, to be safe, and to be part of a team. And, you know, when it comes to the way that we think about our work, I'm forever practicing our craft because it's one of those things that no one person that I coach is the same. So there's a very different kind of practice we need to do. So I find this completely fascinating about how people have thought that they can just wing it, because I just don't think that's possible for long.
Yeah. And then there's a piece that I'll add, which I'm realizing that I now also learned when as a training as a musician, is the ability to observe. Mm-hmm. And I probably picked this up through osmosis with my teachers, because they would point out so many subtle nuances. And that's really something that is helpful for leaders, because so often you don't have these big, you don't reach big goals every day. It's just this incremental progress building towards a milestone. But for founders, for leaders, you want to be able to notice those slight differences in your team, so that you can give them feedback. I call it continuous feedback, instead of waiting until they've done something really amazing or really screwed up. You want to be consistently giving them feedback so that we all love feedback, right? Just so we can kind of gauge how we're doing. And I think that was a skill that served me and would really serve leaders well as well.
So it's interesting that you say that, because there is also this idea of confidence. And I wrote about this yesterday. It's interesting that we're touching on this now. There is something that gets unlocked in a human when you're able to observe and improve on a behavior, an action, a way of thinking that gives them just that little bit of extra confidence.
Yes.
And, you know, you will see their eyes light up. You will see them just stand a little bit taller. They just have this, it is a thing. Now, everybody gets piqued by something different. You know, it might be a point of encouragement. It might be that a point of congratulations. It could also be that, you know, if you say this a little bit differently, stand a little bit differently when you're standing in front of 10,000 people trying to explain to them what comes next, you might actually garner a different kind of response. The communication might actually land a little bit differently. And I think it is, you know, in order for us to observe the way that people are doing things, particularly in the first or second time, what we're often dealing with, and this is the same across all disciplines, it's something that's been hardwired for a long, long time. So the offer or the suggestion of just tweak this little thing, I think, is the only way that you can offer feedback, because there's so much history and context that gets baked into what you're seeing right now, that trying to ask them to make that change is a bit like fundamentally moving a battleship one inch to the right? There's a lot that has to go on to make that work.
Yeah. And it's very powerful also just to reinforce what they're doing, because so many people don't know what they're doing well. They have that inner critic inside of them that's only telling them what they're not doing well.
So true.
And I think we really need to be reinforcing what they're doing well.
Let's talk about that doing well and the idea of elite performers. You know, whenever we think about the people who are at the top of their game, we can think about military examples, we can think about business examples, scientific examples. What do you see the link between people who are at the top of their game in the military and those who are at the top of their game in business? Are there any parallels that you observe in that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I'm always telling founders, you guys are like the Navy SEALs of business. Because they need to be in stealth mode. They need to be constantly experimenting. They have to be resourceful. They don't have a lot of resources like the big corporates do. But I would say the main characteristic of the elite performers that are always improving is the growth mindset. And that is this ability to It's this kind of tightrope of having confidence in your ability to do something while having the humility to know that you don't know everything, that there's always room for improvement. And it's not about not being good enough. It's just, what am I capable of? What else could I do just to improve this skill?
It's super interesting because I think the thing that people aren't taught, I don't think, which possibly is the greatest force multiplier, is the debrief.
Yeah.
I think when it comes to the ability to walk into a rankless conversation where we're asked and we answer immediately or as soon after the event as possible, what was their intent? What went well and what didn't go well? In other words, what are we not going to do again? Allows people who have not had that formal training to drop their shoulders a bit, have a conversation, and allow for that feedback to be free flowing. And in the context of a high pressure entrepreneurial environment where money's always running out, where things just aren't always working the way you'd like them to work, it feels to me like, and I wish I would have done this in my first number of ventures, I did many times afterwards, but the idea of being able to not have resentment build up, not for fatigue to compound on fatigue to compound on something not going so well. There is something about being able to have an exchange with co-founders of your team for them to know as the entrepreneur leading it, the co-founder, the CEO, to actually feel as though there's a humanity in there that you don't have all the answers. Because don't be shocked by the fact that no one's got all the answers. Like this is something we're all trying to work out. And I think that when I've seen that play out with my Air Force colleagues and how they do that all the time, like it is just such a standing part of their culture. And I'm sure the Special Forces guys do it as well. It really does unlock an ability for people to lead and to practice more effectively. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And
Nice.
actually, I find that people struggle with the what did we do well piece often.
Yes.
Because, as I said, that inner critic can be so loud. So, just having the chance, in fact, not just having the chance, having to express what you did well without it being in the context of bragging is a really important skill for people to develop. Because, how are you going to have confidence if you never recognize what you did well?
And there's such nuance in that language too. You're right. Like there is this idea of being able to express what's been done well. And look, in the Australian context, we have the tall poppy syndrome. And so there is forever the need to is it watering down?
Downplay.
Yeah, it's just making it, very, very
Self-deprecating, maybe.
Yeah, it's all of the things that make it very difficult for somebody to go, we did this fantastically, even though what you want to do is make that very, very clear because it is such an ingrained part of our culture that, we don't want to put our head above the parapet too much because it'll be taken off by somebody who goes, well, hang on, just take it easy, be humble, make that work. But at some point there is point of, celebration. And I'd love to sort of meld that into a next question around cultures because you have worked across so many cultures. You've seen the way that different people react and express themselves and the way that their cultures largely determine how they do that. How do different cultures play a role in influencing approaches to leadership?
Yeah, so I grew up in a bicultural household.
Okay.
My mother was Korean and my father American with Scandinavian roots. So very, very different cultures. So
How
I
fascinating.
basically grew up seeing two diametrically opposed reactions to the same situations, which was really a gift because I just grew up knowing that there isn't just one way to look at things. And so I'm able now to go into situations and just assume that there's a different point of view than mine. I'm always curious to know what is the other person seeing? How does the other person see the situation? And I think that's really as business becomes even more and more cross-cultural and global, And it's not just ethnic cultures, it's functions that need to work with each other. Sales is a very different culture than engineering. So just being able to go in and know that there are different points of views, no matter how irrational they might seem to you, just having a little bit of maybe humility to say, here's how it looks from my point of view. I'm really curious to hear how it sounds or looks from your point of view. And you'd be surprised that once they tell you, it will actually make sense once you understand the context, their context.
Which can
And
only ever
that
be one.
goes for Japanese, Chinese, Germans, all the different cultures see things from their context.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because the common thread there is asking great questions. Right?
Always. And listening. And
And
listening.
listening. That's it. That's it. One part of your work, which is very important, and it drew my attention, was the idea around how there are very significant emotional dynamics around how you can have an exchange, the way you can work, the way that progress can be made, or frankly, how it can stop because there is just not the ability to understand where or what is happening in a room or what the dynamics are. I want to touch on this in some detail because I think there's some real value for people to understand how to assess that and how to look at it. Before we get to this, Renita, I just wanted to touch on high stakes environments because, there is context which is important here. The high stakes environment in a military context is very different, although probably contextually as relevant for people who are founders who are trying to do the work and fight their way through to have their creation, their model, their product see the light of day. And it for people operating in other parts of the world, there are an equal kind of high stakes that we often don't see. When you've spent time with elite units like the Navy SEALs and the people who have been brought to help do better manned force management, how does trust and the idea of partnership play a role in those environments in order for them to successfully walk through high stakes environments?
Well, I've been speaking with some of the SEALs because in the military, there it started with a command and control attitude, and they're seeing now that that isn't going to work now. There's just too much. You need to have people in the field helping with decisions because they actually see what's on the ground. So I think you really need to create a safe space for people to tell you what they see. Because if they see that they tell you the truth and you say, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions, then you will start to see people hold back. And what every leader should want is to have the most accurate information possible. And the best way to do that is make it safe to people tell you what they see and what they think. And then to reward them by being curious to find out more and to not throw them under the bus.
Isn't it interesting? So I think one of the greatest misconceptions people have of the modern military and the ones that I've been part of is that there is only one direction with which information flows. In my experience, this dates me a lot. I've served before September 11, which it makes me about 400 years old. And I, in all the units I was part of, in the consulting I've done since then into special operations commands, there is very often a healthy exchange, a genuine fear of missing out on an important perspective, and the ability for soldiers, sailors, airmen who have a point of view to be given the chance to speak up. In a way that is that contributes to the greater good. And there is a very significant recognition of the skill sets that the individuals bring to a team. So if you've been trained in a particular expertise, then the boss will never sit there and say, you will do this job. They will offer their leadership intent, their commander's mm-hmm. intent. And then it is up to the team to work out the execution of that intent. And then there'll be conversations and, of course, countless rehearsals as they go through that approach. And they'll tweak and they'll test and they'll learn until they get it right. And even when that all happens, that plan that they think is great probably won't survive first contact with the enemy anyway. So they've got to try and work through what goes next. And so I think there is a real misnomer and a real missed opportunity for people who are considering going into the military as a career, particularly out of college, where yes, there is discipline and yes, there is the way a service works, but it shouldn't be mistaken for people not being able to contribute given how they've been trained. I think it's almost unfortunate there's a perception that that's how it works because it's very different when you get on the inside.
Yeah, movies maybe. Well, I've had several conversations with Dave Cooper, who is known as the guy who's trained some of the top Navy SEAL teams. He trained the team that went in to get Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the phrases that he uses is he says if he's leading a team, he'll put together the plan, but then he'll go in, he'll throw it on the table and he'll say, what did I miss?
Yep.
What did I miss? And it's such a presumptive statement. It's assuming that you missed something. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it easier for everyone around. Instead of saying, did I miss anything? Does anybody have any suggestions? Which is the same words, but in a different order. And there's a different energy around it. And so by just saying, what did I miss? He's basically inviting people.
I love that. I wish more leaders would do that. Let's pivot now into some of the tools that you've designed to help make that work, right? So when we think about your fast map methodology, I'd love to break that down, get a bit of a sense about how that works, because this plays directly into what we're talking about here. So help us unpack that. And I'd love to ask you some questions on that as well.
Okay. So you mentioned emotional dynamics, and that's the answer to the question. Most people they prepare for a high stakes meeting by thinking about the content. So they have their concepts, their data, their argument, the case they want to make, but they don't really prepare for the emotional dynamics.
For those who are listening to this and are watching this, I'm nodding furiously because I know what's coming and I've been here 1,000 times. Please continue, Renita. I'm sorry.
We all have, right? that moment where you ask for the sale or somebody's distracted and they're looking at their phone and you don't know what to do, or they're hostile, or they're, who knows, they're just seem indifferent or uninterested, or all the myriad of emotional reactions that you can be getting. Not to mention your own. All of a sudden, you're more nervous than you realize. You're stuttering. There's a silence, an awkward silence. What do you do? So that's what I mean by preparing for the emotional dynamics. How are you going to prepare for all the emotions that you feel during, and not just your emotions, what you perceive to be the other person's or the other party's emotions as well?
Yeah.
So people have this conception that empathy is, feeling, understanding how somebody feels and, trying to make them feel better. But I talk about something called strategic empathy, which is really just trying to understand the other person's perspective, their point of view. And so a tool that I have developed is this FAST methodology, which is based on the SCARF method that David Rock came up with at the Neuro Leadership Institute. And FAST stands for future, autonomy, status, tribe, and time. So I've added time as an element.
Mm-hmm.
And so just hearing those words, you can start to see where this is going. These are the key triggers that can put us into survival mode, that do put us into survival mode. And they're not the saber-tooth tigers anymore. It's the Oh, I don't know when we'll be able to get back to you. It's the uncertainty. That's the future trigger, right? There's just so much uncertainty in our world today, especially when you're trying to negotiate a partnership, right? A simple thing like you have a call scheduled for 2 o'clock and it's 2:05 and the other party hasn't shown up. Are they going to make it? Are they just running late? Are they ghosting you? Right? All of a sudden, you're triggered. It's also an autonomy trigger. Now what do? It's a status trigger because now you feel like your status is lowered. They haven't respected the start time of the meeting. Could also be a tribe trigger, which is basically the sense that we belong. Are we supporting each other? Can I trust this person to do what they say they will do?
Yes.
And it's a time trigger, right? I made time for this meeting. And where is the other person? So that just one little event, it's 2:05, has ding, 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 set off all these triggers. And
Which I'm
that's the meeting hasn't even started.
right, and this only gets exacerbated the further you feel under pressure, right? So
Yes,
I imagine
yes.
this is proportionate to the existing fatigue and exhaustion you already harbor.
Exactly.
Right.
It's 2 o'clock. You've already had three or four meetings, up and down, emotional roller coaster. So you've had 1,000 triggers like this already. And they're very tiny. They're very subtle. I call them micro stressors, basically, because each one is creating this mini threat that our body is responding to as if it is a threat to our survival. So that's what I mean when I say founders and people in general are in survival mode. We're literally s detecting threats in our environment.
Yeah, and I think that very much resonates with me, particularly the way that it would come home with me. And it took me, oh, three or four companies to get very like so much better at that. But even then, I still wasn't very good at being able to sort of understand those signs and to deal with them in a way which didn't spill over into every other aspect of life, because you're obviously obsessed about what you're building. Renita, when we dive further into that and we think about this idea of a big act, something like strategic negotiations, trying to work through what could be a defining deal for your business. And there is a need to exercise, I guess, a level of confidence, but also, and more importantly, as you and I know, the idea of empathy almost dialed up to option 10 so that you can understand exactly what you're getting into, knowing that if you're the smaller player, it's really your responsibility to over-deliver so that whatever the negotiation ends up being, you know that you're going to get what you need from this, but you are going to stand out as the partner of choice for the person you're making that negotiation with because you want to be a great partner for them. How do you help people sort of stay grounded through what can, in your own mind, can be ping pong between I need to get the deal I need versus, I need to be very open to what they need. And it can be when you're not experienced in negotiation, and my go-to on this is William Ury, in negotiation. I think he's the best in the world at this. But how do you think about the idea of empathy in that context of something so important like a strategic negotiation, particularly from the founder's point of view?
Yeah, that is such a key skill to develop. There's a mantra that I have used. I used to do sales. I used to sell health insurance, so going door to door, and it was commission only, so the stakes were pretty high. But I realized I couldn't go in there just being attached to making any one particular sale. And so the mantra I learned and trained myself in was committed but not attached. So I was committed 100% to showing up, to helping the person make the best decision for them, without being attached to them making being buying
Clever.
buying.
Yeah.
So for founders, it's the same thing, or for anyone in a negotiation, it's you want to be so committed to getting the best resolution or solution possible without being attached to a particular outcome, because you actually don't know what the best outcome is. So often on my podcast, I have a question about, how did you get the best return on luck? And usually it's bad luck. And there are so many stories where something looked like bad luck, and then it turned out to be a great thing that happened. So committed but not attached is just this kind of way to train yourself to show up fully with conviction, with confidence. And that's when you can really connect with the other person. Because if you're so attached to trying to make something happen, you can't connect with someone else. You're thinking only about yourself. Everything they says is, oh no, they're not gonna sign today, or they're not gonna give us the money, or they're backing out, right? It's all focused on how you're perceiving the situation
Isn't it funny? Use
instead
the
of
term
how you're
conviction.
creating something together.
Yeah, that's right. And you use the term conviction there. And it's such a fascinating one because, when the stakes are high and you're out of money in a startup environment and you need that to work, I've found the people that get most nervous who have not spent enough time thinking about the dynamic, the real empathy that they need, and actually completely overplaying the fact that we need them more than they need us. There is something there where the conviction moves from, I guess, being conviction to being rude, right? Where it just goes from, you are all composed. And I've seen this happen countless times where one person at the end of the conversation, like you said, was definitely committed, but was completely attached. And at some point where things aren't going well, there is not an ejection handle to pull. It is just full force into the deal doing to a point where you start to see the real colors of the other party come to life. And you just go, ooh, I'm not sure this is going to be a great thing for us even tomorrow if we sign a deal here. And the thing is that I think, from a growth mindset point of view, you mentioned earlier, and the abundance of the fact in the world we're dealing with, 7+ billion people, there are other deals to be done. And it might not feel like it in the moment, but taking a step back, taking a breath and going, look, they might not be the right partner for us. And we've seen these signs. If we go further forward with this and we've seen those signs and we go, oh, look, it'll be fine. Just know that that statement, it'll be fine, probably won't be fine. You know?
That's a red flag.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's so interesting. When you think about
And
conviction around this kind of area, how do you define conviction?
I think it's just the confidence in the value that you bring. You know what you know. You also know what you don't know. There's just this sense of I can figure things out. I have certain skills that I bring to the table. It's just really being sure of what you bring without overpromising, without trying to convince anyone, and just owning everything is the way I would put it succinctly. You own your failures, you own your successes, you own your skills, you own your flaws. You just own it. And then you say, and here's how I'm going to, mitigate my liabilities. Here's how I'm going to leverage my strengths. You're just very clear, and you speak without trying to hide or over inflate anything.
It's interesting you say that because when I think about one of the greatest force multipliers for anyone doing a deal or doing a partnership, it's a very clear ask. And the only way that you can have a clear ask, I think, is to have extreme clarity on what value you bring, right?
And yes.
As an entrepreneur, and I'm sure you've seen this 1,000 times before, when there is not a very consistent way of expressing that value and it kind of meanders to fit the landscape of the conversation you're in, it becomes really, really difficult to be able to articulate that value in a high integrity way because you're trying to make it fit the context you find yourself in right now. And I think when it comes down to it, the best business developers, the best CEOs I've had the fortune to coach or work with or partner with have been able to say very quickly, listen, Phil, what we're great at, what we're the best in the world at is this. And if there's a way that we can work together on that, fantastic. But if not, there might not be something there. And right in that moment, you have been saved an enormous amount of time because yes. You can either engage or you can say, oh, that's really interesting. I actually don't think there's something there, even though, to your point before around being committed, you might have prepared so strongly for that conversation. The practice you might have put in was extreme. If you ever get to that point in a conversation, my only counsel is take extreme relief about how that's just given you a bunch of time back. Because it just allows you to move on to what's next as opposed to trying to, you know, put a square peg into a round hole that is never, ever, ever going to fit.
Yeah. I think at a certain level, the best partnership should feel not easy, but, you know, not so effort. They shouldn't be hard.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be having to force every step. There might be some, you know, some strategic thinking and analysis that you have to do, but it shouldn't feel like you're forcing anything.
This is a perfect segue. And we didn't, folks, just so you know, we haven't planned this. This has been a wide-ranging conversation. We do have questions in the background, but it's one question is melding beautifully into the next. When you think about mindset for leaders, and to your point just now about, you know, a great alliance, a great partnership should feel it should feel like it was made to be. What do you think of the mindset shifts, or what do you see in your work as the mindset shifts that leaders need to make in order to be open to those kind of relationships as opposed to having, I've got these 5 things that my business needs, I'm going to go out and find those 5 things and I'm hoping that those 5 things are going to be offered on the first meeting, and obviously they're not. But, you know, what do you think is the mindset shifts that these leaders need to make in order to form great partnerships?
Yeah. Well, it goes back to, I think status plays a lot into partnership negotiations, whether people are aware of it or not. There's always this sense that of your gauging, who has the upper hand here? Who has more leverage? Who, you know, and often, as you mentioned, I work with deep tech founders. So these are young fledgling startups with an amazing technology, but they don't have a lot of resources.
Yeah.
And so they're often going to these large multinational corporates with billions in revenues. And so there's sort of this, you know, perceived imbalance of power. And I would say, actually, no, these big corporates, they need you as much as you need them. And too often I see these startup founders going in with, they're just a little too obsequious, a little too eager to please. And I think that ideally both sides should see themselves as equals, as looking for that synergy. Because whether corporates realize it or not, they do need these startups and the technology that they bring. So that's where the conviction comes in often, that I see founders need to really pump up their conviction so that they can express the value that they bring to corporates, and corporates can get it. And then corporates on their side need to maybe tone down a little bit of their entitlement or even arrogance and be willing to have a little humility about their need for this technology, which may be difficult for them. You know, in the corporate environment, humility is not one of the a virtue that's typically rewarded. So, but that's what's going to make for a more successful partnership. It's not the corporate lording over the startup all the things they need to do in order to work with them.
There's a human side to this too, isn't there? Where we talk about, bottom line, where humans having exchanges, trying to work out if there's a way to work together and to create more value than we could, by ourselves.
Yeah.
When we think about just the raw human factors, and in deep tech founders, I'm going to make an assertion here which could be wrong. The deep tech founders I've met generally are PhD level scientists. They know so much about their field. They may not have had as much selling interactions, human development interactions. And so they really do enjoy their subject matter, but not going out into the broader world to explain it and to be engaging. What are some of these human factors you think that deep tech founders, but also just generally people operating in business, should be cultivating in order to make those that process of engagement to build those go-to-market partnerships just a little bit easier? What do you think they are? I've got a few ideas, but I'd love to hear yours.
Yeah. Okay. I'll go first, and then I'm curious to hear yours. So, as you can imagine, these PhD scientists are very eager to talk about the technology.
Sure.
But often they're speaking to people who are not as interested in the technology. Maybe they're in sales, maybe they're in an engineer, but they're not a specialist.
Yeah.
And so what I work on with my founder clients is finding really seeing the point of view of the person who's going to use your technology. Even if they are technical, they're still a human. So I have had one client who was developing sensors for water pipes deep underground. So you
Okay.
can imagine there's all this wasted water because they're not able to identify where the leaks are.
Yeah.
And he's talking about the technology and the sensors, and they're run by, I don't know, something in the air, you know. But who's going to use this? It's some water manager, someone who's in charge of managing water for a city of 5 million people. Every day he wakes up and he sees that 30%, 40% of their water is being wasted. Put yourself in his shoes. How does he feel every morning, knowing that he's responsible for the wasted water and the cost of that? And so he totally changed his pitch to really come from the point of view of this manager of water for the city. And every partnership has that person who has that very human side that they wake up in the morning, they're like, oh, I got to explain to my, board that this has happened, or I have to explain to this person or my team, or it's that you're talking to people, you're not talking to technology.
It's interesting, isn't it? And I think there is a, I agree with you. I think there is one other component to this, which is you can wave your hands all day long with trying to tell a great story. And there are some fabulous storytellers out there. There is a combination, though, of being able to ground it in objective proof. And so we wrote a piece a while ago around the amount of water being lost through pipes. I think it's something in the vicinity of
Oh.
around a $20 billion opportunity every year.
Yeah.
And we never got to the technologies that could remedy this, but it was certainly one of those things, given that the demand for water will outstrip supply by, I think, about 2060. And so it's a human mission critical issue, right? So we need to get very, very attuned to it and solve for it. And when you're able to ground it in numbers, but also provide the story to make it as connected to somebody's everyday, where in that context, we just, we turn on a faucet, we switch a tap, water comes out, no problems, right?
Right.
Many people in the world don't have that luxury. And so yes. the ability to bring all of those factors together and just allow someone in a moment, because people have different receptors for different types of messages. Some people are all about the objective proof. Some are all about the story. Some are all about the advantage or the disadvantage. And the way that I've seen this work really well is to whatever it is that you're trying to sell, always hit those four things.
Mm-hmm.
Hoping, and not hoping, I guess, knowing that one of those four, you've got a 25% chance of one of those receptors being touched. And for the person on the other side to go, huh, I never thought about it that way. Tell me more.
Right. Yeah.
And I think there's something quite interesting to that.
Yeah. And there's a litmus test that I think of. So if you're just telling the same story, regardless of who you're talking to, or not just story, the same pitch,
yes.
and you're not adapting to it. So the litmus test is if you were telling somebody, let's say pitching or negotiating with somebody, and they just suddenly walked out and somebody else walked in, would you just continue telling going with the same direction, or would you adapt to that new person?
Yeah.
And most people aren't able to adapt. But to me, that's empathy. That's being able to, oh, now I'm speaking to an HR person. Now I need to speak from, you know, the teams having to adopt and change management. And now I have to speak from that angle. If an engineer walks in, then maybe you start to talk more about the technical aspects or, you know, the specs. So empathy needs to be very strategic, very tactical. It's not this touchy-feely kumbaya sort of
That's
thing.
It. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well said. Renita, what advice would you give to leaders navigating partnerships across different cultural contexts?
There's a great book that I would recommend. It's called The Culture Map by
yes.
Aaron Meyer,
yep.
professor at INSEAD. That book will help you realize how much you don't know, or maybe some of your assumptions, and it's actually grounded in science. There's a 7-point map that you can use to see where different cultures stand in terms of, you know, how they handle conflict, how they, you know, how much she has different terms, but for, you know, how literal they are or how figurative they can, like in Japan, for example,
yes.
the society yeah. is so everybody under has the same references. They can just say, you know what I mean. And everybody nods and says, yes, we know what you mean. You didn't say anything. I mean, I lived in Japan and there were so many times where I was like, no, I didn't get it.
I don't and have actually, any idea what you're talking about.
They do that in France too. So these, you know, and then whereas in America, where there's so many cultures, people are used to explaining things more because they know that not one reference is going to resonate.
Yes.
So I would, and again, just that humility about, okay, here's how I see it. Maybe visibly you can see that they're from a different culture.
Mm.
Say, you know, tell me what's going on. Am I missing something? Tell
yes.
me what is different, or how would you handle this in your culture?
It's a welcoming and warm tool to use, right? Where there's not the assumption that you would do that. And I don't know how many times when I've been operating in Germany or in other parts of Europe or in the US, where I've been very mindful about the norms that I don't know. Again, it's that idea of having a genuine fear of missing an important perspective. In that case, missing a perspective that could absolutely tank the conversation
yeah.
that's just about to be had, you know?
Yeah.
And so I tend to play very significantly in learning more about the people I'm going to be meeting. So at least I have a way to connect with them on a very human level. And that might be that, you know, we're both fathers of girls, or that we have
yes.
an interest in sport,
yes.
or there's something that is deeply human that if I see a smile from them, which just suggests, yeah, we're kind of on the same page, that is fundamentally so far more advanced than the paperwork style, you know, the desk research style approach that many do, walking into a meeting and then just flicking on the play button when they walk in, hoping that that's going to land.
Yeah. Well, as a general rule, connecting with other people first is always going to be the best way to go, and then just understanding what is the best way to do that, you
That's
know,
it.
according to their culture. Often it is going out to dinner several times before you start talking business.
That's it. That's it. We only have a few more minutes together because folks, just so you know, Renita is in Paris right now. It is very late in her night. She's been very gracious to be up at this late to have this conversation. So I don't want to take more of your time, but I would love to ask the last few questions that relate to your perspective on the future of partnership in business. You mentioned before, quite rightly, that the world is in a tumultuous place right now, and many countries, at least, are retreating back into themselves and trying to work out what is the best way that they can create economies and well-being for their citizens. In business, 97% of global trade operates through partnerships. It always has. It will probably continue to be that way. What are you seeing in your work as it relates to the power of partnerships for the way that business will continue in the future?
Yeah, it's a very different era now. It used to be that there were companies that could be very self-sufficient. You know, they could do their own R&D and they could innovate on their own internally. And I just don't think that's going to be feasible in today's world. The large companies are going to need to partner with the smaller, more nimble companies that can innovate, because the speed of change is just too fast. So companies aren't good. There's not going to be one company that can do it all on their own. I mean, even look at the large multinationals, how they're acquiring companies to gain speed and competencies. So I think partnerships are only going to become more and more important. And you know, there's a figure of how many acquisitions don't actually work out, how many partnerships don't actually succeed. And I think we need to make those figures much better. We need to improve the effectiveness of partnerships, because that's where all the potential lies.
That's it. No, I very much agree. And look, you and I both know the potential of partnerships. We've seen them, we've experienced them. What do you think leaders are missing about the power of partnership?
I think they're seeing too much risk and change and potential loss of control, status. Again, I really think status is this underlying theme that plays into business in general and partnerships in particular. So they need an exercise where they can really see the upside and see that there are benefits, and maybe mitigate some of their fears, and just help them see the possibilities that they're going to create. So instead of what am I going to lose, it's what if we could actually create this together? You know, look at what SpaceX is doing in the world that we never thought. It was only governments that were investing in space until
That's it.
SpaceX came along and changed. And now we have a whole private space industry. The space industry is going to explode because of private companies and the technologies that are being developed now.
It's interesting, isn't it? I've been reading Satya Nadella's book, Hit Refresh, and he talks about when he first became CEO of Microsoft, and he had his first leadership team meeting, and there was an event that he held that was the most informal that I think his new leadership team had expected from him. And part of that was having a mindset coach come from the Seattle Seahawks to come and spend time with them to understand how they behaved as a group and what they could do together if they unleashed their potential. And what they realized in their first couple of sessions was that there was such an ingrained set of behaviors or feelings around the real discomfort of potentially being wrong, the shame in not knowing all the answers, and frankly, just ego. And how that very potent combination was being, almost proliferated from the top down, which was stopping the entire organization from being innovative and competitive. And I think we would all agree that in, 5+ years that since he's been at the helm, that that's fundamentally changed. And it's really because of what you said, right? The ability to look forward to the upside and realize there is human potential inside all of these different facets of business and in partnership. It can really fundamentally transform humanity for the better.
Yeah. And he is a great example of an emotionally intelligent leader.
Very much.
So it's very good much. To have one in a very prominent position like that.
Very true. Now, I've got a rapid fire to walk through with you right now. I'd love to ask you these questions. And before we do, though, where can people go to learn more about your work? Because it is really high quality stuff and I really enjoy it. So where can we send people to learn more about what you do?
I'm on Substack. So look for the High EQ Founder, mm-hmm. my name, Renita Calhorn, and people should be able to find my newsletter. I also have a podcast there, The High EQ Founder.
Awesome.
And then, of course, I'm on LinkedIn.
We're going to link to all of those because they're well worth checking out. So here are your five rapid-fire questions, Renita. Let's get into it. Complete this sentence. Partnership is?
My favorite word, leverage.
One of my favorite words as well. Question two, what content are you loving at the moment?
There's a podcast that I discovered when I was preparing to moderate a panel on space. It's called The Valley of Depth. Nice play on words. And
yes.
They interview a lot of innovators in space, nuclear, and defense tech, which, Ooh. As you know, is a hot topic.
Yes, I'm gonna look that up. That sounds very good.
Yeah.
What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
Anytime somebody says, oh, you can't do that, or it's hard to do that. So, you know, people will say, oh, it's so hard to find an apartment in Paris or Tokyo or New York. And I have found amazing apartments in amazing ways in all those cities. And I'd love to share just a quick story because sure. it's relevant to partnerships. I once worked with a CEO back in the dot-com days. And this was actually before my time working with her as a general manager. So the company was struggling. It had, I don't know, very little money left in the bank before they would go out of business. And they had an incredible technology. This was the beginning of the internet. They had this game technology. So one of the large media companies was very interested in speaking with them about this technology. But she didn't have enough money to wait several weeks for the meeting. So she said, you need to send me a check for $50,000 before we have this meeting. And she would not have the meeting until they FedExed the check for $50,000. Who does that? But she had this conviction and they did it because they wanted the chance to meet with her. And you can imagine if she had asked anybody, should I do this? That they would have said, oh yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
They would have told her it's not possible. No major corporation's going to send you a check for $50,000. So that's one of my favorite stories of how far conviction can get you because mm-hmm. they could deliver and they did. And she had just had the chutzpah to ask for it.
That's amazing. That is quite something. Maybe we should be doing more of that kind of asking, I think, in business. When you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
I start to think about what they care about. And these days with social media, you can go on and you can see, you know, are they mentioning their kids? Are they mentioning CrossFit? Are they mentioning a conference that they just went to? You can just learn so much about what they care about and why. And I really do my homework to find that out.
Yeah, I love doing that too. It's one of those things that can pay back massively when you do it well over time. And finally, what is one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
I'm actually grateful to be alive at this time where it's pretty messy right now, the whole geopolitical situation, the way people are being treated. But I think it's that messy part of, you know, the cocoon, the caterpillar, before it turns into a butterfly. I think I'm an optimist, and I believe that we have the potential for the world with all the technologies that we have. We can solve so many of the world's problems now with technologies that already exist. So I'm very excited to see how things evolve and hopefully play a role in part of it.
I'm loving that. That's a great way to end this episode. Renita Calhoun, thank you so much for giving me time to walk through all that we've covered tonight. It has been a real pleasure, so thanks for being here.
Likewise, Phil. Great conversation.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hayes-Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.